Hello, I'm Will Shires, and this is Talking Trucks. In this episode, I'm chatting with Des and Dennis Evans, co-writers of the book The Road to Zero Emissions. Both men have some strong views on the UK's quest for zero emissions and believe the diesel engine will be around for another 100 years. But before we get onto that, Des is going to talk about his time as MD of MAN Truck and Bus UK and give us a fascinating insight into how the industry has changed in the past five decades. If you enjoyed the podcast and want to stay abreast of everything that's going on in this industry, then why not subscribe to Commercial Motor Magazine weekly? For great deals, head over to www.com-mot.com. That's www.com-mot.com. Right, I'm joined today by Des and Dennis Evans, who are the co-authors of The Road to Zero. Welcome, guys.
Yeah, welcome.
Before we get started, now, Des, I know a lot of our listeners will know a lot about you. How long were you MD of MAN Truck and Bus UK?
Well, I started with MAN 30 years ago this month, actually, back in 1993 as Sales and Marketing Director. And then in 2004, 11 years later, I took over from Jürgen Knorp and I was the managing director there until 2015. So 22 years in total.
Yeah.
50% as sales and marketing director and 50% as managing director. And it was quite a roller coaster of a ride.
And what have you been doing since?
Well, I spent 6 months recovering from a stroke. Which was quite interesting. And since then, I've been involved with Aston Business School as a visiting professor in their servitization function. And also, I've been a non-exec director of Mercedes-Benz group of dealers and an advisor to one or two other transport companies. So I've been more of a spectator of the game as opposed to being on the pitch. But I've kept in touch and I guess one of the reasons why we're meeting today is that I still have some fairly strong personal views as to how the industry's going and where it should be going.
Excellent. Yeah, looking forward to hearing those. And Dennis, same question to you. What's your background?
Well, I'm a little older than Des.
Go on, how much older?
10 minutes, different days, yeah. I like to say that I taught him all he knows. What I didn't do is teach him what I know. And to some extent, that's what we're going to talk about today, I guess. Now, I'm the same as Des, 48 years in the industry. Started off working in the industry selling Isuzu trucks for General Motors in Zululand. I was there for a year, and then I moved to Ford Motor Company, broadened my horizon and started working in Angola all the way through to Mozambique, setting up motorcraft centres. Came out to England, and sadly, because my parents had died and I had to help Des picking my family up. I had four sisters, three of them were still at school. But I ended up getting a job with what was then British Leyland, which became Unipart, which became Rover, and I had a number of positions across the Rover group for 18 years. Heading up parts operations, heading up Stirling Motor Cars. I was a director of Stirling Motor Cars in Miami. Anyway, I came back to England, worked for Land Rover, was on their launch of their first new Land Rover in like 25, 30 years. BMW bought us. I met Peter Streeter and Reitzler and got involved with the Mini, which was our project Harley. And strangely enough, I worked on the Mini that nobody ever saw, which is the Mini that we were working on before Reitzler and Peter Streeter threw their hats in the ring. That's another story for another day, I think. I've still got the pictures there. It's a very interesting car that nobody ever saw. I left to join Mayflower Vehicle Systems for 18 months. And I was their sales and marketing director. I spent some time in Brazil setting up Body and White Systems, and then came back to England, joined Des, working in after sales as initially head of parts, then head of after sales business development. And I retired hurt in 2016. And in the last two or three years, I've been very active in researching the book, obviously, and writing the book with Des. But the last 12 months, I've also been very active in a Ukraine humanitarian project.
Oh, have you?
Collecting and delivering aid into Poland and Romania for a lot of distressed people. With the help of MAN, they gave us two trucks for the thing.
And Dawson Group.
And Dawson Rentals, a good colleague of mine and Des's, Steve Miller. So we ran four trucks. We had a number of military mates that helped out with the driving and the collection, and that's been very interesting. And now, and probably the next 12 months, I'm hopefully going to be involved with Des advising various people on what they need to do to make the net zero challenge more realistic than it is at the moment.
Now, before we get on to talking about electric vehicles and saving the planet, something I did want to ask you. The last few years have been horrendous. What, we've had Brexit, COVID, increasing costs, vehicle shortages, Ukraine. Yep. Are you glad you aren't doing the job you were doing? Because that must be a headache.
If I'm brutally honest, I think I had the best years. And I say that for two or three reasons. I started as a graduate trainee in the Ford Motor Company empire, and I can honestly say the 2 years training with the Ford Motor Company was just outstanding. And then spent 15 years with Mercedes, where I had another couple of years of business management training with Mercedes. And it's those periods within my career helped ground me in what this industry really needs. And from that, I have to say, I had a fantastic career. Today, I think, hopefully, I don't want to be unkind about this, but the business is run by, it's run by accountants, it's run by non-salespeople who are remote from the business. And it doesn't surprise me that somebody like Elon Musk, who owns and runs Tesla, is now the most valuable automotive company in the world, that has a market cap greater than every other OEM put together.
Yeah.
And he understands the market. And I think if you take organizations like, say, Volkswagen perhaps, or Ford Motor Company, General Motors, that used to lead the way, then they need to really think carefully how they play in the market in the next 20 years. It's not as sociable, let me say that. I mean, it's a people business, and I would say that I would always pride myself on my accessibility to the people and to the market. And I think the industry today looks, it's run by invisible men. It's a non-contact sport now.
Yeah,
I think it's an interesting corollary to what you were saying. When I started in the business nearly 50 years ago, I was trained by General Motors, and we actually cover some of the detail in the book. But the interesting analogy of how vehicles were sold 50 years ago to how they are sold today is quite interesting. They had a program, General Motors, and it was called the GO program. It was called that because it meant get organized today. And there's a very famous Italian New Yorker who worked for Cadillac, and he's the most famous...
Joe Girard.
And I don't know whether you ever heard of him, but you look him up. He's in the World Book of Records of the world's greatest salesman. And on our training programs, they showed us videos of Joe Girard. And what Joe Girard used to do, he knew nobody in New York when he got there. So he used to send postcards, different type of postcard every month. You know, happy Christmas, happy Easter, happy Valentine, to people that he didn't know. And people used to come to the dealership to find out which idiot had been sending these cards. Anyway, over a 12-month period, initial 12-month period, he built a relationship with people out of curiosity, just by ripping two pages out of Yellow Pages, personal and business, and sending out these postcards. And that was the one thing that I remember from the training that General Motors gave their salesmen that 50 years ago. Today, you have Salesforce, you have artificial intelligence, you have algorithms on a database.
It's impersonal.
That's generating leads for people who don't have to send postcards out now.
Yeah.
In fact, they don't even have to go out the office because he's probably mostly done on telephone sales or some kind of super sophisticated marketing. But just the two contrasts of 50 years ago, what people did, what people thought was good. In fact, what I did, I actually sent postcards out to people in Northern Natal. My first sale was to a farmer, an Irishman who ran Connemara Farm in Northern Natal by Howick Falls. I sold him an Isuzu LUV, but only after I got 12 of his African planters in the back of the truck, and we went for a test drive in the fields, and nobody fell off, so he liked the truck. But today, I can't imagine going out with postcards to people anonymously. You'd probably get done under some kind of...
I would say this, Will, that the commercial vehicle business, and this is what we're talking about here today, commercial vehicles, commercial motors, it's a completely different business from the car and the van business.
Oh, totally.
Because the specification requirements, the application requirements...
It's a rational decision, not an emotive decision.
The fleet management requirements to manage in real detail requires human contact. Mm. It requires human beings to contact human beings. It's a far more social interaction. Cars, and even vans, you can do it online. There's a lot of talk now about... you know, the online business. But at MAN, we took the decision, 20 years ago, to go MAN direct. Because I knew, and I bet the company on this, the value of human contact with the customer base. Mm-hmm. That you needed to be very close to the customer. They needed to know that you were there. They needed to have personal contact with somebody. And that's not to cut the dealers out, because we looked after the dealers very well. The dealers, we manufactured a service contract for the dealers that today is arguably the most profitable franchise in the business. We're here at the home of Cord Wallace in Thomas is the owner. I've known him for 30 years. Even he says to me now that this is still the best franchise to have. And by creating a direct sales force, we managed to move MAN from a 1.5-2% player to a consistent 12-13% player, to be market leader in the 6x2 tractor sector for a period of time when we launched the Tracknology generation back in the year 2000. And we did that on the back of personal contacts. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was the most exciting time, it was the most rewarding time. Mm-hmm. And I still believe today that is still the main focus that manufacturers should have in terms of knowing their marketplace. But I think if you cannot adopt a car strategy to a commercial vehicle.
No.
I think for me the concept of selling and buying as it was 50 years ago is completely redundant. When you think about today it's all about usage. You pay for use.
Yeah, total cost of ownership.
Well, not only the total cost of ownership, you basically pay through a really detailed understanding of the business model that you're hoping to serve. So most of the commercial vehicle operators aren't going to shell out 100 grand, 150 grand. They're going to basically say, over 5 years, I'm willing to have this cost as part of my operation. And most manufacturers, I think, will end up always owning the vehicle. And if you take two examples, number one, Tesla, number two, Fisker, which are two vehicle models that I know.
Yeah, that's the car game.
I know it's the car game, but it's examples of the manufacturer will always own that vehicle. Fisker is an interesting example because their vehicle is designed for 12 years and they will take that vehicle off whoever's using it after 12 years because they're going to recycle it. So you've got the emergence of business models where manufacturers are absolutely owning the asset for life and enabling the end user to participate in a usage scheme, not an ownership scheme, where the things that we've all worried about in the past, like residual values, future values, selling it, losing money, all those kind of things will disappear. So I think we've got to look at 50 years ago, this is what it was like. Today, 50 years, it's what it's what it is. But in 50 years' time, I can imagine something completely different to how acquisition and usage and ownership will be very, very different.
To give you an example, I remember going to, it was in 2014, in my last year, and I was going to the MAN stand where I was going to be present for the 2 or 3 days. And I was walking into the hall with a couple of really big truck operators who are also personal friends of mine. I won't say who they are. And I said to them, right, we've got several of the manufacturers here today. We're going to go to the MAN stand at some stage. But where do you want to go first? And both of them, these are guys I've known for 40 years, who we used to go to Earl's Court before we went to the NEC.
And Bingley Hall in Birmingham.
And it was all about the product. It was all about the hardware. And they both said to me, it's almost as if they'd rehearsed it, I'm not interested in the product. Go and show me the lowest cost of operation. Take me there and I'll go and spend some time there because that's all I'm interested in. And it was really quite an interesting discussion that we had then for half a day about. Mm-hmm. You know, then we produced all our marketing on the basis of the iceberg. 90% of either the cost or the danger.
It's nothing to do with the price of the vehicle.
It's nothing to do with the hardware. The hardware accounts for 10% or less of the operating cost. Mm-hmm. The two biggest costs, particularly in a 6x2, 44 ton application, which happens to be 40% of all vehicle sales every year, 130,000 of them operate in the marketplace. The two biggest costs are fuel and your driver, and they both interact, and the driver can affect the fuel. Yeah, so you really need to understand how you can make a driver a better driver, and how you can maximize using the lowest amount of fuel. Those are the two most important things. And the design of the cab, and whether your night heater gives you this level of heat, or it's almost irrelevant. So I think this is where the business has changed. From when I joined it in 1973, and when it was all about price, it really was all about the price of the truck, and you had 100% capital allowances, and people used to buy and own their trucks, to today, people like the Dawson Group, asset managers par excellence, they are giving the marketplace what they really need.
Yeah. And, also, I think you've got to consider where the consolidation over the last 20 years of fleets of consolidating to a small number of large, big multinational organizations that control the fleets. It's not like 50 years ago, when what do we have? 32 manufacturers in the UK. There are now 6 manufacturers in Europe. You know, there's maybe...
Not one UK-owned.
Not one UK-owned, yeah. And maybe in India and China, let's talk about the Asia, maybe up to 12. So it's a smaller constellation of manufacturers, but it's even a smaller constellation of big hitter logistics and distribution operators that control the fleets. I think something like 75,000 O license holders exist in the UK, but 1,000 of those 75,000 control about 80% of the vehicles.
Yeah.
So I think manufacturers have to, and I think increasingly, it's all about managing international or national accounts. And you're talking completely different business models of acquisition methods and financing methods, usage methods, where you've got seasonal businesses and you suddenly need a great big influx over Christmas, for example, by either the post office or people that are involved in seasonal goods. You don't want that fleet explosion for 12 months. You want it for 3 months. So everybody's recognizing these shifts in business usage requirements, and certainly the ownership models and the concentration of where the big fleets are. And again,
I think
your sales organization needs to react to that.
The biggest change in the last 20 years, and I can give you the date, 24th of March, year 2000, when we introduced the Trucknology generation and the digital truck. Replaced the analog mechanical truck.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the biggest impact on this industry has been the introduction of telematics.
Yeah.
and the development of companies like Microlise.
Yeah.
Where I actually would advise them to introduce a new verb into the English language. Stop analyzing and start microlizing. Because if you microlize your business, not analyze it in a general, but microlize your business, it is like the small gains, the marginal gains. We talk about it in sport, we talk about it in football, in rugby, in cricket, the marginal gains. It's the same in transport. Motor Transport 100 always used to be a bell chart for me. Every year, Commercial Motor Transport talked about the Motor Transport 100 and showed you the average, you know, the upper quartile, yeah, of business performance. The average truck operator, and I remember John Gregory from Gregory Transport saying, his trucks, he runs 800 trucks, mainly tracked units, operating at 44 ton, they make £5,000 a year. £100 a week, £20 a day. The average return on sales, 2 to 3%. 2 to 3%. The average truck generating 150 grand as an average, probably closer to 250 grand today, but 150 grand, the average truck making 3%, 4.5, 5 grand. Now, if you can get half a mile per gallon better from your 100,000 mile a year truck operation, yeah, you will improve your bottom line performance by £5,000. You will actually double your profitability. And it is these applications of digital fleet management, the development of what I call professional fleet managers, business analysts, have done more to bring about change than developing a new cab. You know, tire wear, accidents, insurance, all these things. So if you can look at the pyramid, the iceberg, and you can attack, if you can get 10% off the bottom 90% of your costs, yeah, a 9% improvement, you will quadruple the average transport operator's profitability. And mm-hmm. these are the things that are important. And I think in my career, certainly with MAN, the big change for me was the introduction of that capability through a direct sales force, having knowledgeable people, not only in sales, but also in after sales, and developing a real state of excellence in the service operation. You know, I've also carried that on a little bit now with Aston Business School, where in their servitization or the advanced service group, which is what they call themselves at the business school, that's what we teach. We teach how to manage big data and how to microlize your business and to get these marginal gains. And it's amazing how many organizations and businesses don't do that, and yet it's there under their nose. Because you then have to just do two things. Establish your competitive advantage over your competitors and provide the customer with a value proposition. Those are the only two things you need to do, but you need to do it with capable people. And I think that was really the hallmark of my last 20, 25 years in business.
Well, we're talking about major changes. Of course, the industry's going through one of the biggest changes ever now with decarbonisation.
Yeah, what's that about?
Well, the silly thing is, you go back 100 and something years and Commercial Motor magazine was full of electric trucks. You know, it was like a VHS, Betamax kind of war going on between combustion and electric. But ultimately, as you know, combustion won. You've got to wonder where we would be now if electric had won. We wouldn't be panicking and trying to rush through everything.
Well, you would have had 100 years to develop the infrastructure, which is one of the things. It's interesting you bring that up, because 100 years ago, and I learned this from my ERF days, the divide and the division at the time, in 1933, I think it was, when the Foden family went one way and Edward Richard Foden became ERF, because he chose diesel over steam. And it's a bit like that today, only I think we're choosing steam over diesel, because there's so much hot air about what we should and shouldn't do, and we're listening to more people like Greta Thunberg, who in my opinion has very little knowledge of the applications that are required in transport today. And transport is being denigrated and penalised for all the wrong reasons. The last 100 years of internal combustion engine has done more for prosperity and for saving this planet than anything, any other invention I can think of. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be around, certainly for heavy goods vehicles, and by heavy goods I'm talking 15 ton and above application, which is 80% of transport requirements in the world. It's going to, my prediction is that the diesel requirement will still be around in 100 years time, because it's still the most economic and the most environmental application to transport goods around the world. Yeah. even on ships and the ship's containers. And I'll give you one example of what I believe the diesel engine can do today. And I think I've told you this several times now. Well, a 500 brake horsepower diesel engine operating in a 6x2 44 ton application today in a Euro 6-4, it would take 100 of those units to produce the same level of emissions as a Euro 3 vehicle of 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah, people just don't realise this, do they? They don't know how clean...
The reality is...
The vehicle park is dominated by Euro 3 and below.
With AdBlue tanks, with diesel particulate filter exhaust systems, which is the main piece of Euro 6 emission controls, the air coming out of the tailpipe is cleaner than when it went in. And my recommendation to Mr. Khan or Mr. Starmer or anybody else who's prepared to listen, go and put 100 44-ton tractor units with engines running around Westminster for 24 hours and measure the pollution and the air quality after they've been running. We can then redefine a 44-ton tractor unit as an air freshener. I think that would be a very appropriate title for it.
Yeah, fantastic.
Try it.
So what do you guys think about the government's current timetable for decarbonisation?
I think it's ridiculous. 2030 for passenger cars and vans, 2035 for other commercial applications. It's ridiculous. It's the pressure on vehicle manufacturers to bring about this change is enormous. It's expensive. And we're not ready for it. And I'll give you two examples. The two big hurdles that any government, and in particular the UK government, need to understand. First of all, if we are to retain the 1.5, 1.6 million vehicles that are assembled here every year, currently with internal combustion engines, with battery power packs, we need to build 3 35 gigawatt factories that can produce 500,000 units each year and then have assembly close to the production site of the batteries. It takes 5 years to build a gigawatt factory, minimum. It takes $100 million to produce 1 gigawatt. So multiply that by 35, it gives you some idea of how much it costs. It's in the region of 10 to 12 billion. That's what's needed to build 3 gigawatt factories. So we need to talk to the entities and the organisations to help them invest that sort of money. It's got to be done by private enterprise, not governments. So that's building the vehicles in the first place, and then that will save around 800,000 jobs.
There's a million jobs at risk at the moment.
Possibly a million in the supply chain, but certainly 200,000 that are currently operating in the 9 production sites up and down the country. Mm-hmm. So that's building the battery production sites to convert to electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. But there is no point in building vehicles when there's no infrastructure. We need 400,000 charging points. Today, yeah, we have less than 40,000. So you could argue we've got 7 years to build. No. You need 400,000 charging points. And that is if those charging points are in the right location. So an electric vehicle charge has got to replace a 40-litre tank fill, which takes 2 minutes.
Mm. Yeah.
You can fill a 40-litre tank, yeah, in less than 2 minutes, and it will give you a 500 mile range. How long will it take to give a 500 mile range on a current electric vehicle when the average range, even if you believe all the publicity, is about 250 miles?
Mm-hmm.
So battery production sites, still no deal, still no reality. Infrastructure, still not realised. And we want to get all this done by 2030? Not a chance.
I think the thing that the government has missed,
in my opinion,
missed the opportunity. I mean, there's a big chapter in our book, chapter 5, and it's all about what we call freight ports, not free ports. Big difference between free ports and freight ports. And as part of the levelling up strategy that they wanted to embark on over the last 2 or 3 years, instead of focusing on a third runway at Heathrow or extending HS2, they should have focused on brownfield sites that existed, where within the lifetime of a parliament, and I'm talking about 60 months, 5 years, 60 months, they could have produced symbols of real progress where people who don't necessarily understand the goal of 1.5 degrees retention, but they can understand, how do I get my job back if I lose it? What is the opportunity for my children to go and work in an interesting industry? And what we've identified is 12 sites around the country that are ex-car and truck manufacturing sites. You know, for example, Swindon Honda just lost 3,500 jobs. 1,700 jobs were lost in Bridgend, where they used to make engines.
Southampton
has lost jobs. Luton has lost jobs. Castle Bromwich, where they used to build Defenders. And Browns Lane, where they build Jaguars. These are all interesting sites close to what will be zero emission zones. We're 1,000 acre sites for what I call a future-proof business park of the future, where a coalition of green technology industries can coexist, where a solar farm and a gigafactory can inhabit, where a recycling centre for recycling not only batteries but recycling vehicles can exist, twinned with innovative
recharging sites.
Well, not just recharging sites for 1,000, 2,000 vehicles, but also linked to logistics, warehousing, distribution partners. Also, with the university campus on site to sort of look at the research that could be done to actually demonstrate that change is happening.
Hospitals, surgeries.
Well, also things like test centres for the future of automotive. Driverless vehicles, driverless trucks. People are going to want to have confidence that those can work properly. Now, what could have happened is a test site in Honda or a test site in Bridgend could have been commissioned 2-3 years ago and could have been up and running by next year, within the lifetime of the current parliament, to demonstrate progress in transitioning to a net zero strategy. But without the right infrastructure, the focus just on saying the emissions that come from vehicles, we need to stop production of those vehicles, is just so short-sighted. And part of the goal that Des and I had in looking into what is really required from an infrastructure point of view in our book, The Road to Zero, was to focus very much on the infrastructure needs. Give you one last fact, right? There's 136, 35 gigawatt factories either being designed or operational right now. China has won the battery arms race. They've got about 110 of these. Europe has 8, America has 6, Britain has 0. So we're not even in the race anymore. And if you look at what the Faraday Institute have forecast over the last 2 or 3 years, this is a government-sponsored organization looking into technology of the future related to the electrification of fleets. They're forecasting at least 200,000 direct automotive industry jobs, and maybe up to 1 million direct and indirect in the supply chain that will be lost. Because if we don't manufacture powertrain here, we will definitely not assemble them. And right now, that's the fact. It's 2023. It's 5 years since I started researching this book. And despite lobbying, you know, okay, Grant Shapps and all the other people in the government, nothing has happened.
Okay, there's one other thing maybe on government strategy. And let's take Mr. Khan and London as an example. The strategy seems to be focused on prohibiting current internal combustion engine vehicles. It's focused more on stealth tax as opposed to wealth taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Wealth taxes come from the production and the creation of value. Stealth tax comes from the penalising those people that offend the current strategy. There seems to be more focus on penalising people entering their place of work or their place of where they have to be or to shop. So the other big thing that, other than helping build 335 gigawatt at a cost of between 10 and 12 billion, which, by the way, if you stop the HS2, or at least had 10% of the HS2 budget, you could do it.
Yeah.
So why not?
Yeah.
And the building of the infrastructure. What's going to replace the £37 billion a year that is currently collected from the 37 million vehicles, 390,000 of which, by the way, happen to be a truck, which is the most penalised product in the population of vehicles. We've got to replace £37 billion of income, primarily from vehicle excise duty and fuel tax. Fuel tax being the biggest, 27, 28 billion. So 70, 75% of the tax rate is through your fuel charge. Now, how's that going to be collected? That's going to be done, I would suggest, through data management of telematics from the vehicle.
And your electricity bill.
Possibly, but yeah. You will be able to, the government will be able to track everywhere you go. Well, the vehicle that you own, if you are the registered owner or user of the vehicle, your vehicle will be tracked. So if you do the average 6,250 miles or 10,000 Ks, because if you look at Glassy's Guide or any of the other, that's the average mileage a year, 140,000 kilometers for a heavy truck. So these are the sort of parameters. You will be charged by the kilometer or by the mile at various times of the day. So it'll be a variety of charges, but will they achieve the 37 billion? I would suggest that focusing on penalising the motorist or the traveller is one area of tax collection. Yes, they've got to do it, but a much better focus for tax collection would be on creating the wealth through the production and the other industries that can come off the back of this industrial change and transition, like the freight ports, where we're going to develop over the next 100 years, yes, a greener society, but based on an evolution as opposed to a revolution. And the time frame, to answer your original question, Will, the time frame of 2030 and 2035 is for the birds. It is just not realistic.
So you think at some point they'll realise this and it will be delayed?
Absolutely.
Yeah, no question about it.
Yeah.
And do you know what the irony of all this Brexit wise is, that the primary European manufacturers, being Volkswagen, who's the biggest vehicle manufacturer in the world, they own 12 brands, including the biggest truck manufacturers in the world, Scania, MAN, Navistar, and Volkswagen Commercials.
They've done that.
They, along with Daimler and Volvo,
yeah,
and
Navistar,
and Paccar, Dutch based, it'll be the European manufacturers, I believe, that will do the lobbying to bring about the change at the EU level, which the UK and presumably the rest of the planet will have to follow. That's on the assumption that China and India and America all follow the rules, which I doubt very much.
I think the other thing is, just we spoke about it earlier, Will, is the choice of technology that will underpin emission-free vehicles in the future. It's not well understood by most, and certainly most in government, about the technology choice that we currently have. At the moment, lithium-ion is dominant. It's also dominated by China. China owns 70-80% of the world's access to lithium and cobalt and other rare earth materials that are necessary. However, the man responsible for lithium-ion technology 30 years ago was recently credited as a Nobel Prize winner for chemistry, Mr. John Goodenough, a German USA professor in Austin University in Texas. He's also credited with the solid-state technology. And solid-state's quite interesting for a number of reasons, but the main reasons being, one, from a battery powertrain point of view, it's going to be half the weight.
Nickel and zinc, not cobalt.
I'll come on to that. It's going to be lighter. It's going to be combustion-free, no risk of any fire. It's going to take minutes to recharge, not hours.
And hold the charge longer.
But give you much bigger range. It's almost like double the range that you would have in a typical Tesla. And not only that, the main...
This is the VHS.
Well, this is the VHS Betamax argument, if you like. But it's going to be sourced using sustainable material from Greenland, which is one of the reasons I think Donald Trump was thinking about buying it off Denmark, but maybe not.
Canada
and America, where something like 90% of the world's zinc and nickel deposits exist. Not Congo, not Bolivia, and not China and Russia, where currently 90% of the world's cobalt is sourced with various degrees of poor sort of people management. So two things are going to have to happen. The press has got a great opportunity to raise the level of understanding of the technology choices, raise the level of awareness of the infrastructure challenge we really need and we really must meet. And then let's try and see if we can get a coalition of sort of government and private practice to coexist and create a 5-year, 60-month parliament friendly plan to genuinely raise the bar but level up with a proper infrastructure plan.
I've got another view on this, and this may be fairly radical coming from a manufacturer background. Who are going to be the manufacturers of the future? Because a Tesla is a computer with a set of wheels. It's essentially a laptop or a tablet. Where's Apple in this? Where's Google in this? Where's Microsoft in this? Are they not going to be the manufacturers of mobility units for the future? Right, okay, we call them cars and we call them vans and we call them trucks. At the end of the day, they are units of transport. And it's all about the data. It's all about the data management. I can imagine a situation where, just like in your laptop computer there, you have Intel, the Intel chip, Intel inside, yeah? Why not have Tesla inside, or Apple inside, or
some Microsoft inside?
And somebody else is putting the structure together, but it's essentially, it's an Apple car, or it's a Google car, or it's a Microsoft car. And I think that this is the challenge now for the industry. The conventional vehicle manufacturers have been, in my opinion, have been clinging to the wreckage. Clinging to the wreckage of hardware. And they've been ignoring the power of software and intelligent applications, because that is the innovation that's not only going to drive the business, it's going to create a greener workplace, it's going to create more intelligent, sustainable jobs, cleaner jobs, safer jobs, better paid jobs. And I think it's going to be the breakthrough, which we're seeing with Elon Musk. There will be a breakthrough. I don't know who that's going to be. I doubt it's going to be the current traditional players. It could well be that the Kuwaiti Investment Office or Geely, who are the two biggest shareholders in Daimler, who profess still to be the biggest manufacturer of trucks on the planet, it may be that Daimler may be managed in the future by some chip manufacturer or some the operating system is the key to this.
Well, Dyson tried it, as you know. He tried to sort of move into the vehicle sort of design for electric vehicles and pulled out because of the cost. But that was when he was looking at the cost of batteries. And the cost of batteries at the time, you were talking about $500 per kilowatt hour. Yeah. To be competitive today with a diesel, energy. It's got to be below 100 kilowatt. $100 per kilowatt hour. It's the same for hydrogen. Hydrogen has been spoken about a lot. Toyota are big fans of hydrogen, interestingly. So are people like JCB with some of their diggers in mining situations where you don't need a driver. However, the challenge for hydrogen, there's two challenges for hydrogen. One is you have to get below $12 per kilo, because that's what it is. It's got to be at least $2 per kilo, just like the numbers on lithium. It's also got to be green, because at the moment, something like about 60-70% of hydrogen is manufactured through coal-fired power stations. So it's brown hydrogen, it's not necessarily green. So if you want the wheel or the well-to-wheel analysis to be good and green, then that's got to change. And I think we're still some time away from hydrogen being a sort of a scale solution.
But I still think about alternative fuels for use in an internal combustion engine application.
Yep.
I still think there's a lot of mileage left in that.
No, so do I.
And at scale. And maybe, you know, is it possible for us to think that the likes of Saudi or Kuwait or Qatar or Brunei to think in terms of investing all their fossil fuel based sovereign funds can now look at developing other alternative fuels other than fossil based? Surely that must be within the realms of possibility.
I think so. I think, you know, without wanting to sound like a McKinsey consultant, but I'm going to. You need a balanced scorecard of energy mixed energy solutions that will provide, let's say, the outcome that we're looking at. And it could be, you know, look at what we've got to do to improve homes in terms of insulation. Look at what we've got to do in terms of maybe changing the diet. There was something like, there was one fact I read in the research we did, 1.6 billion cows producing tons of methane. There was an additive in the food that one chemist was producing that had the equivalent of AdBlue in the food, to feed to the cows to reduce the methane.
Oh,
so there was an AdBlue solution up the arse of the cow to reduce the methane. I mean, these things exist, but what I'm saying is that forget 2050 as being the closure date for when we, you know, no longer
you
see fossil fuels. We shouldn't put a date on this. What we should say is we're going to plan over the next 50-100 years awareness of the climate challenge that we face, and with a mixed energy usage sort of program of activity for transport, for industry, for homes, for individuals, right, that we coexist with what I would call a green technology sort of agenda that doesn't exclude energy efficient fuels that we have today. And like you said, some trucks are air fresheners, some aren't. We can live with...
Okay, but there's two other things we've got to do as well. I think one of the most important things, and it's not being discussed at any great level, is education.
Mm-hmm.
And starting in junior schools.
Mm-hmm.
Kids aged from 6 to 10, and then from 10 to 18, we've got to start educating them about what can be green and how it can be green, and teaching them more science-based capabilities that they can invest their own time and energies in. Because you know the operating systems of the world and the science behind the operating systems of the world and this so-called AI, an artificial, I don't like the word artificial intelligence, it should be advanced intelligence based on a data management, an algorithmic
capability. It's an oxymoron, really, isn't it? Artificial intelligence.
It's a ridiculous description. It's not artificial at all. It's advanced intelligence. And we should be applying this to the solutions, and that's got to come through education and through a change in our education system and a focus, you know, more on this type of capability than media studies. And I apologise to all media studies students. Oh, and one other thing. Here's an example. Here's an interesting story for you. One of the seminars that we did at Aston Business School a couple of years ago, and we had 115 postgraduate students in a lecture about operational management in a manufacturing scenario. And one of the questions came up about the future of autonomous driving. And I answered the question in this way. The question was, how will autonomous driving affect the demand for future vehicles? Interesting question. Will people still want to own and drive and use autonomous vehicles? 115 students in this lecture hall, 50% male, 50% female, average age between 23 and 29, 80% of them not from UK. First question. 115 people here, how many of you have got a license to drive a vehicle out of 115? The answer was 9.
Really?
9. Second question, how many of you own a vehicle, actually own a vehicle? 4. And then the third question, and this was the key to the subsequent discussion, how many of you have got an Uber account? Everyone. And then the discussion started. The future of transport is not whether somebody wants to buy and own a transport unit. Yeah, they want mobility.
Mm-hmm. That's what that's
and then
about.
The discussion started. Then the discussion started about the future of transport and about the availability of usage on demand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Transport as a service,
mm-hmm.
yeah, not as a product.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was even more amazing that I learned recently. In the age group 17 to 25, I think it was, the DVLA, 70% of the 17 to 25 year olds in the UK, 70% haven't got a license. So who are the future drivers? What are we going to do about HGV drivers?
Yeah.
We're probably going to have autonomous driving because there aren't going to be any unless we import another
mm-hmm.
7 million people over the next 10 years, which is what we've done in the last 10 years. The population of the UK now is 69.2 million compared to 62 million when this government came in 13 years ago. 7 million more people, 5 Birmingham cities more. Yeah, this is also part of that problem as well. So, yeah, there's lots of issues with this green strategy or this net zero or not zero strategy, because trying to get to net zero of carbon decarbonisation. It's an impossible dream.
Yeah.
An impossible dream.
Is it safe to say that if you were a haulier, you wouldn't be investing in an electric truck at the moment?
Definitely not. No point, because a Euro 6 vehicle, one, is more economical, it's as environmental, and if you take, for certain applications, so for bus operations that are doing 100, 200 mile routes a day, where you can have recharging overnight or for the next shift, or for waste management operations that do 100 miles a day, and they have their 70, 80 drops, yes, you can do it. Electric trucks have a fantastic proposition on electrifying.
For niche vehicles and for vans, I think electric will be the dominant fuel system. For medium, long distance,
15 ton and
heavy,
above,
heavy stuff, it won't take off.
It'll be diesel for the next 50 years, if not the next 100 years, in my opinion.
Really? 50 to 100 years?
Yes. Yes. Because let me put it to you like this, and I had this discussion with Steve Miller at Dawson's. The average tracked unit today, 6x2, 44 ton, which is 40% of all vehicles purchased, commercial vehicle-wise, in a 35 to 40,000 market a year, yeah? It's 120 grand. If you were to electrify that, it's 360 grand. It's mm-hmm. three times. The average rental is probably £500 a week for an internal combustion. For a diesel, for an electric, it'll be £1,000 a week minimum if you can get and the electric vehicle trend. Because what will defeat it, your diesel engine vehicle has a range of 1,000 miles. Your electric vehicle, at best at the moment, it probably won't be more than 500 miles. And also, it'll be a lot heavier. So you're going to be penalizing the payload as well. So, I think... And this is where governments, and particularly this government, whoever is going to govern this country over the next 5-10 years, for heavy goods transportation, which is responsible for 90% of all the deliveries to supermarkets, to oil terminals in the UK, diesel fuel, and it will certainly be for the next 25, probably 50, and probably beyond that, in my opinion.
Yeah, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Did you see? I'd like to be proven wrong.
I think the other thing sort of come out in the last few, to be honest, the last few months, is there was a very interesting article in one of the newspapers the other day. I think it was the Times, and it was also been on the radio about owners of car parks. Have you heard about that?
No.
Worried about the weight issues related to
Multi-story car parks.
Yeah, yeah. Related to vehicles parking, yeah. Especially airports, because a typical, let's say, take a Mini, the original Mini, 30 years old petrol vehicle, 650 kilograms. A Mini Countryman today, fully kitted out with an electric powertrain, 2.5 ton. So you multiply, you suddenly have a big car park full of vehicles that are weighing several tons each, instead of less than 700 kilos each, then suddenly you're going to have to start thinking about, do I ban certain vehicles or do I sort of reinforce my my parking?
Yeah, they're worrying about bridges as well, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. So one, you've got a lot of issues. I think the other big thing, what Brexit and the Ukraine conflict has taught us, certainly in the last 12 months, is that electricity prices are always going to be going north, not south. You add the electricity hike to the potential to hike your fuel costs when you thought you were buying something where it was going to be next to nothing. There's some doubts over the future of the stability of energy prices in a certain format. Whereas if you have a look at the price of diesel and petrol, it's coming down and it'll probably stay down for
a
long time.
Haven't we got a grid that's capable of delivering the energy?
No, we haven't got a grid, that's true. So for me, the coexistence of multi-energy choices over the next 50, 100 years will be the way to go. We build an appropriate infrastructure for commercial vehicles, for what I call the last mile and the long haul. So where long haul meets last mile is where you put 12. I'll tell you another story in a minute. You put your 12 freight ports in the UK to manage the freight movement in the UK. There was a study done by somebody who was involved in dealer network planning, and this study looked at where was the concentration of freight movement in the UK, where 80% of the freight was moving to and from just in the UK, and it was something like about 12 within 12 locations. Something like about 80% within a 30-mile radius is where most of the freight coming into the UK and out of the UK was moved. Interestingly enough, they were all close to these 12 locations that we have identified as X manufacturing operations, who are all close to zero emission zones or soon to be zero emission zones. So for me, the eco transport infrastructure that the government has failed to develop because they've been concentrating too much on just banning the vehicle or putting sleeper lanes in place in city streets, they've not thought about the bigger picture and how to involve the wider commercial industrial sort of academic partnerships to make something happen and happen within the lifetime of a parliament. And I think there's absolutely a case for that to be done.
Well, the other interesting, I don't know what the word is, but what are we, statistical anoraks. Yeah. But the one thing that sticks in my mind every time I pick up this new statistical piece of information, 50% of the population of England live within a 50-mile radius of Bakewell in Derbyshire.
Really?
When you think about it like that. So why not, if you want to get the majority and start with England, if the SNP still talk about the English Parliament, England with 55 million people,
yeah,
you've got to get it right there. You can't go and do an experiment in Wales or Northern Ireland or Scotland, because you know, even when you add all those up together, it's still only around about 10 million. There's 55 million in England. So 50% of the population live within a 50-mile radius of Bakewell in Derbyshire. So there you can spot up the Birmingham, the Liverpool, the Manchesters, the Sheffields, the Hull conurbations on which to put all your freight ports. And this is where this whole HS2 white elephant needs to be reconsidered.
Yeah.
I mean, this was one fact. I'll read from this if you don't mind. But in the book, we looked at emissions by industry sector across the globe. And we just looked at the USA and Europe. Transport and agriculture were the two major emitters, if you like. And there was a popular opinion that we should ban burgers and eat plants. And a recent study identified that 1 kilogram of beef generated 60 kilograms of CO2, but a kilogram of carrots had a carbon footprint of 0.4 of a gram. However, 1.6 billion cattle are roaming the planet and produce 140 billion litres of methane per annum. And scientists are working on an additive enriched feed to reduce emissions, like, you know, giving the cow AdBlue. Right?
Yeah.
But the time frame for any success is likely to be 30 to 40 years. And the other big fact was that while we understood China stood out as a major polluter, because it's still reliant on coal fire, yeah, the fashion industry in China had a carbon footprint 40% higher than its equivalent in Europe because of its power choices. Yet we still buy tons of material from China.
And that's not accounted for in the UK CO2 emissions.
Yeah. And this is what we said. We basically said, one of the summaries in our book, in our thoughts, was that while industry in itself is generating a third of the emissions that need to be controlled, it's where we've identified that supply chain coordination of effective solutions, this sort of management of multi-energy choices, needs to be more considered. And, you know, obviously that, you know, the choices between air freight and shipping, for example, where the carbon footprints are very, very different. And there are some critical decisions that, you know, the world's political economic power players are missing in action at the moment. And
The other thing is this, Will, you know, if all these numbers are correct, there's today, based on 2022 annual figures, 37 billion tons of CO2 is emitted on the planet. 37 billion.
Okay.
The UK is responsible for 1%.
Yeah.
1%. That's 370 million tons. All right. Whatever we do, until and unless China, India, USA, and Russia collaborate,
yep,
and operate at the same level, whatever we do, we will not move the dial. We will not move a single. We can probably salve our conscience and say, well, we've done the right thing.
Yeah.
But there will be a very big price to pay, yeah, for not moving the dial at all.
Yeah. Yet Greta Thunberg doesn't go to India and Russia to
exactly. Campaign. So why don't these just stop oil? Why aren't they in Beijing or Moscow, yeah, or Jeddah or Riyadh? If as all these politicians like to do, they look at the numbers, and it's if you look at the numbers, it's quite interesting. Per capita in the UK, 5 tons of CO2 per capita is emitted. The average car, of which there's 33 million in the UK, doing less than 10,000 kilometres a year, emits 2.5 tons. Of CO2 a year. So the question could be, should we get rid of the cars or should we do something about the population? The average van, 10 tons. The average tractor unit, 100 tons. Boil it down into those little sectors. You can then start looking at giving targets for reducing your impact accordingly. So in a car, instead of doing 2.5 tons a year with your 10,000 kilometers, maybe use your bike a bit more. Reduce your mileage from 10,000 k's to 8,000 k's.
Don't have a car, car sharing, like with Evo.
Exactly. The van, you know, doing 50,000 miles a year and emitting 10 tons of CO2. Mm-hmm. Well, can you drive a little bit carefully? Can you train your driver, or can you have an autonomous drive? You don't need a driver at all, and then we'll see what happens there. And on the truck side, I mean, and this is where it really winds me up. The truck business, and okay, I've been in the truck business 50 years, but I've seen a revolution in truck management where I can remember taking my test back in 1975 in an Atkinson Borderer with a 180 Gardner engine and a David Brown 6-speed crash box that did 5 miles to the gallon, and it was a 28 ton. And today you can get into a 480 MAN pulling 44 ton and do 12 miles to the gallon. Yeah. So the development has been seismic, and with proper telematics and proper fleet management capability, you can reduce tire wear, you can reduce fuel, you can reduce all your CO2s, you can reduce accidents, insurance. These are the things that you can now do, and the transport industry needs to be applauded for it, not denigrated.
Yeah, it doesn't get the credit it deserves. There was one other big failure in the latest Rishi Sunak announcement about his plan for, you know, COP out 26, or 27 actually, and that was, he's going to go down the carbon capture route. I don't know whether you know much about carbon capture and storage.
Oh, what a ridiculous,
but this is a fault to the oil companies who have been doing certain things. Like, I know a couple of them have built carbon capture systems in Switzerland, for example, at the cost of millions of pounds. It took them ages to do it.
Doesn't work.
It's not only that it doesn't work, it does work, but one, it takes years and years and years and years. Maybe you've got a 30-year sort of horizon before you see the impact. The other thing is that $250 per metric ton, annually, you would need, to spend three times the cost of the mitigation of COVID last year globally to do it. Now, nobody's going to do that. There's no $10 trillion budget anywhere in the UN's coffers, as far as I know, to go down the carbon capture route. So we've got to go and do something different that's sensible, that's affordable, and can be done in a time frame that's not 30 years. But that was the cost that we discovered through some research that we did, the World Resources analysis of carbon capture. And they just basically said, don't even think about it.
$10 trillion is available through all the sovereign wealth funds. It needs to be invested in that stuff. Yeah. And it can be in other alternative fuels, for instance, and still use the basis of an internal combustion engine.
It's been dispelled by lots of people as a fop to the oil companies for them to continue drilling. Yeah, go, here's your license. Yeah, we're going to stick a hole in the sea and start storing carbon that's come out of our power stations that we're continuing to run.
Either.
It's not a solution. I mean, I'm not an advocate to that at all, but it's one of the factors we were putting in to our study about what are the things that we can do and should do. And certainly that's not one of them.
Okay, so how do we sum all this up then, Mark?
Well, I was hoping you could say it's all summed up in your book and everyone needs to go out and buy it. And
Could be.
Yeah, well, in our book, if anybody's interested in buying it, we dedicated it to a glacier in Iceland that no longer exists. And there's a monument at the bottom of that glacier in Okajo in Iceland. And it's in our book where we dedicated it. And that monument has what it calls a letter to the future. And the letter basically says, we know this glacier no longer exists. We know what to do, but will we ever find out whether we will achieve, what needs to be done to stop what's happened here? Worse than that effect. It's a great monument and it's a great sort of stone at the foot of this glacier. So we wrote a letter to the future, But our book was essentially our letter to the future. My plea is that commercial motor transport and your organisation continue to write letters about the future to those people that in the future are hopefully going to be making the right decisions in government, but also in industry as well.
It can't all be put at the foot of governments. Governments are there to provide the scaffolding. Private industry and sovereign wealth funds are going to be the answer to creating the future platforms. And we need to have a little bit more, knowledge of what these sovereign wealth funds intend to do, are going to do, and governments should help and guide them towards doing the right things. But banning internal combustion engines by 2030 and internal combustion engines for commercial vehicles by 2035, in my opinion, is completely wrong.
On that note, thank you both very much. Lots of food for thought there. So thank you for your time.